This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it is all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you with me for the next hour on Sirius 216, XM Channel 204, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and available anywhere you get your podcasts each and every week. Well, on February 20th, my guest on today's show completed the process of disbanding his stable. That wrapped up a brilliant 46-year training career in which he saddled 1,709 winners with earnings of $48.6 million. Grade 1 winners such as Exchange and Bordonero and Amazombie and Midnight Bisou will highlight his resume, but there are so many other horses and people which contributed to his success. And today, I have the privilege of welcoming trainer Bill Sparr to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Bill, really appreciate the visit here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time, and I'm really excited to walk back through memory lane with you. I know there's so many great stories and memories that you're going to have from this training career, but, you know, when the news came out that you would be stepping away from this career that began in, 1977, I guess, you were quick to point out that you were not retiring. So was it a difficult decision to make?
Very, very difficult.
How have you been dealing with it so far?
Not well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Let me explain. I miss my horses.
Yeah.
I miss working with them.
Is it strange to wake up and not have to go to the barn?
Yes, but I wake up at the same time.
Which is pretty early from what I understand.
2:15 every morning I wake up. Yeah.
Why were you always at the barn so early?
It's the way I was taught to get there. I'm at the barn by 2:45 or 3. I want to see how the horses ate up and go over their legs with my help. And that's it took that time, and it's quieter then. You can do more with a horse when there's not so many attractions of getting away from what they need to do.
That might be earlier than Wayne Lucas.
We were good friends. We brushed elbows sometimes at the donut shop, so pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you mentioned missing the horses, and I can imagine that with any trainer, when they finally decide to stop training, that's got to be the one piece of the puzzle that's, you know, you get to see the people, you can call the people that you were associated with, but not being around your horses, that has to be the most difficult pill to swallow.
It really is, Mike. I'm still not over it yet, but eventually I will.
What are you doing to fill your time?
I go out every morning early, and we place some horses with different trainers, and my owners that we put with other trainers want me to kind of look after their interests, and I go by the barns and just check with some of the trainers, everything okay with their horses, and I'll take some of the trainers have a lot of horses, and I can deal with their owners because I know them very well, and it's working out pretty well so far.
Okay, so you are still going out to the track in the morning, and you're still around the people and the trainers that you gave your horses to, so that has to help a little bit.
It does. It really does a lot.
In some ways, does it almost make it a little more difficult too, Bill, because you're seeing those horses and you're back around it again and you just want to be involved?
Yeah, not really, because they're in good hands. And I applaud the guys we have for doing a good job. And I didn't really appreciate the work they did till I'm actually working with them.
Yeah. What led to the decision to finally say enough's enough?
The overregulations.
What does that mean?
It means that there's too many regulations. That the way I look at horses and my background, I think they're doing more damage to the horses than good.
Yeah, almost as if, and I've heard this from other trainers, almost as if it's difficult for you to do the job that you've done for almost five decades.
Exactly. Let's take an example. I've been around this horse 24 hours a day, and this doesn't act right. I can't say it for sure. Maybe he's sound, but I don't like the way he's going. Legs seem okay. Maybe it's the shin. Maybe it's the knee. Before, just to make me feel better, I'll x-ray maybe the shin just to make sure. I don't think it's the shin, but I'll feel better doing it. You can't do that anymore because the siren goes off that there's something wrong with the horse.
Even if there's not.
Yeah. When they come and look at them, they don't really ask Bill, how's this horse doing? Is he galloping every day? They just go right at the horse like they want to find something, you know, and instead of going, I don't want to find anything unless something's wrong. And I think it's a lot. I don't blame them individually. I think there's a lot of pressure, undue pressure by other means on them.
So now that you are not training, I know you said you're not retired. You said you're still going to be around. You obviously are. You're out there every morning. Do you see yourself as more of a advisor to other trainers now, or is it not like that?
You could call it that. I don't advise them. I just kind of work with them if I can help them out. But anyway, with a background of the horses that we gave to them. And then I see, you know, some things I can do. You know, yesterday I found out they're going to close the track, both tracks real early. I sent messages much earlier than it was announced that I knew that they were going to close both tracks to all these trainers that we have. It gives them a couple hour heads up to know how they're going to handle their health the next day or two. Just little things like that.
Talking with trainer Bill Sparr here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. He wrapped up that brilliant training career at the end of February, and now he is learning how to live without his horses. If you just heard him talk about that, how he misses his horses every single morning, but he is still around the game and he's not going anywhere. And Bill, I can tell you, there are a lot of people that are going to be very happy to hear that news.
What news is that?
The news that you're still around the game, that you're not leaving the game.
Yeah. I actually own small pieces of a couple horses. So it keeps me in the game, and I'll probably continue to do that.
Let's go back to the beginning. I mentioned that your training career began in 1977, but you were around the sport even before then. So take me back to the very beginning with Bill Sparr. How did you first become interested in racing?
It was either 1957 or 58. Some of the dates I'm still not exactly sure. I had a neighbor that was a exercise boy and a trainer out there, and he was a small guy. And what makes these horses tick? You know, I worked some nights when I was going to college and in a liquor store at a market, and then we sold the forums. And I started, when it got dull, I read the forums, and I didn't understand it. So I asked him, and I started going out in the mornings with him, and I could become interested in what makes them tick. You know, these fast works that mean anything or do not. And then I found some jobs that what's the first thing hits the ground? Where are their feet? Well, where's the top shoer? Oh, like a guy named Leonard. So, hey, can I watch your shoe? And, well, yeah, okay. Well, I found out the grooms liked it because I'd hold the horses for them. And I did that for a few months. And who was the But the best vet, well, I found out the top trainers who they use, it was Bob Baker. And so I asked him, you know, can I just watch him? Well, I do surgeries at night at the farm, and I really don't need any. So I started wheeling around with him just to watch, and he was doing surgeries late at night, and the horses wouldn't recover till midnight or 1 in the morning, and he'd get there later. So I started going around to the barns that we did work for, which is quite a bit, and I take orders. So when he came in, I was ready. I knew, well, Buster needs to see you right away because he's got one that looks like it's going to get colic or something. And Whittingham maybe have one that he needs to look at right away. So after a while, he said, I'm going to start paying you. But I did that for worked for them for like 14 years, in and out as a groom too. But I got started that way.
Yeah, you mentioned
right way.
Big names, Charlie Whittingham, Buster Millerick, Hall of Famers. What was it like being around those individuals in our sport? They're icons.
Great knowledge. They got there early. They studied their horses. And I learned a lot from those guys. I learned a lot.
Tell me a little bit more about Buster Millerick.
Oh, the greatest. Oh boy. He was a good guy. Everybody thought he was a gruff guy, but he always had a little dog with him. And he, I got to tell you something that they pulled a joke on me. And this was in the 60s. One morning, you're going to like this. We were in his office and he said, they're both chatting. They're up to something. And he said, Bill, will you go down? There's a horse down there in stall so-and-so. He's got his eye needs a little cream in there. It looks like he scratched it. Can you put it in for him? And I guess so. I'm thinking, why me? I said, yeah, okay. And he said, where's the stall number? And they're talking, and he said, right there. So they give it to me. He said, oh, you're going to need this little stool to go with you. What do I need a stool for? Well, you're going to need a stool to get up. So I go down to the stall, and there's this big black horse. And I look up, and I said, yeah, I might need that stool. And it was Native Diver.
Oh, come on.
No, they're laughing. They were playing a joke on me. So, yeah.
I love it. Yeah, but those are the kind of stories that add to the legend and the lore of thoroughbred racing. There's so many of them out there.
I got a lot more.
I can't wait to hear them. It should be great. And we have plenty of time here as we are with you right up until 7 o'clock Eastern time here on the show. All right, Bill, so Buster Millerick, Charlie Whittingham obviously had an influence on the way that you went about training horses and ran your operation. But tell me about more people that kind of had an influence on you in the early days.
Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
Terrell Jones. Ted Saladin. Gene Cleveland. Wow. See, just name some train. We did most of we did all the surgeries out at Halzo's Ranch in the evenings. And so whenever the trainers would get into trouble with their vet, would maybe give vitamins that it was their vet. But when they get a horse that they weren't sure about, they would call us up to have Baker look at them. And I was part of that. And we did some of the surgeries in a stall for some of the small surgery we could do there at the track. We did pretty much Tommy Doyle.
Wow.
Reggie Cornell. Just kind of go barn to barn. Who am I leaving out? Evan Jackson. He was a character. we did pretty much the whole barn area.
Yeah, and to say that you learned from the ground up, I mean, that's how you got started in the sport, literally from the ground up.
But what did these guys do different? You know, they were good horsemen. They were good horsemen. They studied their horses. Knew what they ate, and they knew when they come out of the stall in the mornings they were there. And it made a difference.
what's the difference between a good horseman and somebody that's just a good horse trainer?
A guy that's there knows how the horses ate up, come out of the stall, watches them go to the track, watches them come back. That's the good horseman. Experience, the ones that had practical experience.
Yeah. And considering, Bill, that you stepped away from training because of, as you said earlier, over-regulation, if somebody comes to you today, a young man, a young woman, and they say, hey, I'm thinking about getting involved in training racehorses for a living, what advice do you give them in today's environment with the way the game has changed?
I would tell them, don't do it. Just don't do it, because I think we're dying. I really do. This crisis, then these new regulations are ridiculous. But I would sure help them if they were adamant about doing it. I've even helped some of the younger guys over the last few years, the ones that asked me questions of, you know, what I'm doing. We were saddling a horse a couple years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and the horse was moving around a lot. And Daryl, my assistant, was, as you put the saddle on, and I'm going to get on the tail. And I got on the back end, and I grabbed the tail and started moving the horse back and forth so he'd keep his balance on his hind leg. And I had my shoulder on his hip, so if he went to kick, he's going to push me away. He's not going to kick me. And it makes it easier to saddle the horse because he's more concerned. The horse is more concerned about what's going on with his back end. And a new trainer walked by, and he was watching me, and he said, what are you doing? And I explained it to him. I said, and he says, oh, that's cool. You know? And I said, this guy is going to go somewhere because he asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
And he has.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you were no stranger to asking questions of all those legends that you were around back in the day.
If you don't ask questions, you're not going to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you got to – so many trainers come on this show, Bill, and they tell me that you can learn in this game every single day, no matter how much experience you have. Do you agree with that?
Charlie Winningham told me, Bill, there's never two horses exactly alike. There's always something different with them. He is absolutely dead on.
Hmm. Yeah, really interesting stuff. Bill Sparr with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, so 1977, you begin your training career. What do you remember about trying to get started with everything?
I had no money, and there was offered like 3 or 4 horses, and I had no equipment. And so I think I had like $150 in my pocket, and it was at Del Mar. Who do I go to? My friend Buster Miller. He always had all this tack was always taken care of. And I said, Buster, I got a chance to get some horses. You got any for sale? Like, I need a bridle and a saddle. And he said, yeah. He said, Brownie was his foreman. He said, Brownie, go down and get Bill a couple of saddles and a couple of bridles. No, Buster, I can't afford that. I can't afford that. He said, it's just a saddle and a bridle. Just give me a D-bed or snaffle or something like that. Brownie, go down and get him two of each. Okay. I said, he says, Bill, look, you win races. I don't want your money. You win races, you pay me back.
That's perfect.
I paid him back.
How long did it take you to pay him back?
Probably almost a year. Probably.
Sure.
You know, when you get started. Yeah. You know, he told me something else that I want to share with you and he said, you're claiming horses. He said, you're claiming some horses that aren't doing well because you think you're going to move them up. And I said, yeah. He says, claim horses that are doing well and then move them up. I said, yeah. You know what? He's right. See, I asked questions. See? Anyway. That,
that's great advice.
It's great advice. Great advice.
When you started claiming horses and got more involved in the sport and you started to make a name for yourself, did you always remember that? Would you try to find horses that were in pretty good form that you could claim and move up?
Yeah, I did change a little bit my looking at them, but we marked legs. There was 4 of us they included me, and it was Farrell Jones, Dale Landers, myself, and who was the other one? And we would take each week or so to do it, and then we would mark extra programs and hand it to the other guy. There's Dale. Maybe it was just the three of us. It was Farrell, myself, Dale. Anyway, we marked legs, and I learned a lot by doing that. Following why is the horse dropping, and well, his legs always look good, and now he had the tendons starting to fill or something like that. And maybe the body didn't look the same. I also marked the legs, the body, the condition of the body, if he gets hot, and the equipment on a horse, like, you know, the bridle they have on, is it a ring bed, is it an outside bur, what kind of blinkers? They got an outside extension, well, this horse is getting out. Well, maybe I don't want to deal with that. And he wasn't doing that before when I go check my other program. So it eliminated a lot of horses, and it brought a lot of horses back into the area where we could maybe make a good claim.
That's interesting. So as you're getting started in the late 70s and you're working to pay back that money, was there ever a time, Bill, that you thought, oh, my goodness, what am I doing here? I can't do this for a living. What am I doing?
Yeah, on the bad days, yeah. we got off to a pretty good. I started up north. I wanted to get established. I had three horses, and I went up there to Bay Meadows, and it rained for 2 months straight. But we did pretty well. And who would I have next to me? I had a guy with three stalls, John Sheriff.
No.
Yeah. He was working for a farm for Henry Freitas. It was a farm there, and he would come in and out with these horses and train them at the farm and bring them in and run them. And we become good friends. And eventually, you know, he worked for me for quite a while. Later on, he took when I got really big, he took the second string, and he's a good horseman. He's a good horseman.
Yeah, it's got to be fun for you to see all the success that he's had too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. A good horseman.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. I didn't realize that he worked with you.
Oh, yeah. He worked for a couple of years. Uh-huh, yeah.
Wow.
Yep,
who are some of the other trainers that came through your operation like that, like a John Sheriff? Were there other trainers that are doing well now that you've kind of taken under your wing a little bit?
Oh.
I know you're close with Phil D'Amato, right?
Yeah, I met him. I was really good friends with Mike Mitchell.
Yeah,
and he was him with Mike Mitchell. I met him through Mike. And they're the good. Now here's the guy there has a lot of horses, and he's there early in the morning, and he's there when he goes to the races. He's wearing the same outfit he had when he was there in the morning, so he's there around the clock. And I'm able to maybe take some of the pressure off of him because he has so many. But he does a good job, and he has a lot of good help. Some of my good help, when I disperse my stable, I send them over to him. Some of the two really special people. Good horseman, good. I got a good hot walker, I had a good groom, and they both went with him. He just made a spot for him.
How did you decide which trainers you wanted to take care of your horses?
I really didn't do it like that. I asked the owners who they wanted, you know, and who they follow and wanted, and somebody that I could work with to help them out with the background on the horses. And Phil popped up right away, and then it made it easy for me because he's going to let me at the barn all the time and check with the horses with him. Bondi was one of them. Rusty Brown, he has a lot of horses with him. We got some with him. And then Pettison, Dean, got a couple. I think that's about it. I tried a couple of the trainers that they did. They just had too many horses, and they didn't want to get any more horses.
Well, I guess that's a good problem to have, right? When you're a horse trainer,
yeah,
you've got too many.
Yeah, that way, you know, Mike, that I think it's with the economy the way it is, inflation, that the middle trainer, the guy that has the 16 to 20, is in trouble. You either have to have 40, 50 or more, or just four or five that you can get on yourself and take care of them yourself. It's just it's so expensive to train a horse anymore.
What does it cost to train a horse, Bill?
Without vet bills and in shoeing, I would say $115 a day, maybe even $120.
Mm.
I know some guys, that's what they get now, and they rightly so.
Without the vet bills and the shoeing?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My goodness. Yeah. I mean, the economics are difficult. They always have been, you know, but there is more money available if you have a good horse, but those horses are few and far between, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, my bookkeeper does a lot of books for different trainers, and he said, you know, even if you're winning some races, doesn't mean you're covering the bills. You pretty much have to have a real good horse or two in stake races to do it.
Yeah, and you've had plenty of those. We're going to talk about them in the second half of the show here in a little bit. But what was the first horse you remember that kind of made you feel like you could do this when you were getting started? You know, maybe a horse that started to put you on the map a little bit.
How about Reef Stage?
Yeah?
There's a story that goes with that. I had Hobie Alder and Fred Carrillo were partners, and we were doing really well, and they wanted a horse for Pomona. And I said, oh, there's a horse that lugs in all the time, and he would really fit the Pomona called Restage, and he was running in the last race. I think it was either 12,500 or 16,000. And that's when we started doing a trainer could put in two claims.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he's a pretty good horse. He's difficult to train, but I think we could do well. So you'll love the story. So he said, well, put in two claims. There'll be a lot of claims. Yeah, there's a big drop in there. So I put one in for Hobie and one for Fred Carrillo. So the horse stumbled out of the gate, and he gets up, and he wins. And he got a good claim. So we go down to the claim box, and there was like eight claims. And when he lined up, said when they were on the P's up, and I said, wait a minute, don't shake yet. There's not enough claims in there. Oh, Bill Spar, you got your two in there. They're all mad because I had two claims in. And I said, no, there's not enough. No, we're going to go ahead. And I said, no, you don't do it because there's not enough in there. So they went ahead and they shook the P's, and I got it. Forgot which one. It was Hobie or it was Fred. And now the guys are yelling, oh, maybe he's right. You know, maybe he's right. And so they talked him into going to check the claim box. And one of the claims, their white envelope, was leaning against the box. So we had to go get that one out and go shake again. So I got it for the other owner. So now they had to bring security down there. The guys were yelling so much like it was something wrong. And one of the stewards was Dave Samuels, came down, and he grabbed me by the hand and started walking me away from him. And then he said, where are you going? He says, I'm taking Bill to Vegas. That horse ended up, I think I run him twice at Pomona, and he won both starts. We'd like double or triple. We went a whole lot of races with that horse. Somebody said, like 13 races we won that horse? I'm not sure about that, but win a lot of races.
Wow.
But, yeah.
Is that the same? No, I just went back to Equibase, as you mentioned, Restage. Is that the same Restage that ended up running in Agua Caliente at the end of his career?
I'm not sure where he went.
Yeah, I wonder if it was. After he left your barn.
How many races did he win?
It shows that he won 19 races and 64 starts.
Yeah, we went 13 races with him.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a cool horse. We went we were racing nights, I think, at that time at Los Allen. He went like allowance races for us. He was a cool horse. He was difficult to be around, but we got along with him.
That's a great story, and
all
part of what started to get Bill Spar's career underway. We're going to continue to talk more about that and look back on some of the big-name horses he's been around. There have been plenty of those, too. We'll do that in the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't get lost in the shuffle. Nominate your yearlings today to Phasic Tipton's selected yearling sales, where the deck is stacked in your favor. Starting with the Phasic Tipton July sale in Lexington on July 11th, then the 102nd Saratoga sale in Saratoga on August 7th and 8th, and the New York Bred yearling sale in Saratoga on August 13th and 14th. These summer sales annually deliver industry-leading results for sellers. Stand out at the Phasic Tipton selected yearling sales. Nominate now at phasictipton.com.
Eclipse champion Blaine. A proven sire with over 15% lifetime stakes horses. His recent top runners include graded stakes winner and Kentucky Derby hopeful Litigate.
Litigate, gonna go on to win it here.
As well as Kentucky Oaks hopeful Wet Paint. Also an emerging broodmare sire, his stakes producing daughters include the Dam of Eclipse champion and Kentucky Derby favorite Forte.
Forte to win the Breeders' Cup Dominion.
Blaine, standing at Claiborne Farm.
There's plenty of thrills at Gulfstream Park during the championship meet with live racing Wednesday through Sunday. Don't miss the Triple Crown prep races, including the Fountain of Youth Stakes on March 4th and the Florida Derby Saturday, April 1st. Enjoy the races outdoors from the Carousel Club, our Feast in 10 Palms, offering a premium view of the races. For stakes schedules, reservations, tickets, and more, head to GulfstreamPark.com.
Perennial leading consigner Eddie Woods is off to another fast start in 2023.
New Grange takes the San Pasquale, but Hopkins is too strong, finishing up powerfully to win the Palos Verdes, and it's Newgate to score by about a head. Reincarnate to take the sham. It's Rocket Can to win the Holy Bull.
Additional 2023 stakes winners include Occult, Lane Way, and Sharar, who took the Jumeirah Derby in Dubai. Find your next winner at the Eddie Woods consignment at OBS March. Visit eddiewoods.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it is Force Freeze who's taken the lead, and Force Freeze being confidently ridden. And Force Freeze shakes loose. Jackson Ben now coming. Here's Amazombie coming with his run as well. On the outside, A Priority's running a huge one. They are homeward bound, and Force Freeze desperate to hang on, but Amazombie's wearing him down. Amazombie, Force Freeze have it to themselves with a 16th to go. Force Freeze is shifting out, but Amazombie's got him. And from here on in, it's just a matter of how far Amazombie and Mike Smith have won the Ascension Jet Breeders' Cup Sprint. Force Freeze was second. Jackson Ben came running on for third. And then it'll be close for fourth. Amazing Destiny and Aconite.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Trevor Denman with the call of the 2011 Breeders' Cup Sprint, a race you heard right here with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Amazombie, so good that day for trainer Bill Spahr, who is my special guest on this show this afternoon. If you did miss any portion of the conversation so far, you know what to do. Just head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our trainer talk shows at your leisure. That's horseracingradio.net. And you can do it on every major podcast platform as well. Go back and listen at your leisure and follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Well, Bill, I know that that had to bring back some incredible memories for you. Trevor's call of Amazombie winning the Breeders' Cup Sprint in 2011. Boy, what a special day.
Sure was. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, and he was such a tough horse. What do you remember as you were listening to the call? Put me there with you. What do you remember about watching him win that race?
I was in the paddock. I was on the ground floor, and I wasn't really sure where he was at. And I was there with Chris Applin, one of my employees, and she was getting on the horse, and she's yelling, "Billy's going to win the race. He's going to win the race." And sure enough, he won the race. And I was upside down, you know, it's the way we got him that made it special.
Yeah. How did Amazombie come to be for you?
Okay. A few years back, we were at a farm in Hemet at Judd Morris's farm. And we're looking at the babies. It was cold day. It was foggy. We all had our hoodies on, and we were walking to watch some of my set go, and two horses were walking by, and Judd says, "Hey, Bill, look at these two horses here. They're for sale." I says, "I haven't got any money." He says, no. He said, look at him. He said, the guy passed away and the family doesn't want horses. You probably get a good deal. I said, I still don't have any money. And he said, he kept pushing me. And I said, okay, just to make him go away. I said, well, which is the best one? He said, well, that one over there, this horse called Smoke No More. And I said, now listen to the wording now, Mike. I said, well, if you got him for $5,000, it would be a good deal. So, okay, that over. He said, he'll take it. The next day, I said, oh, I told my bookkeeper, we got to get $5,000. Just bought a horse. So a couple of weeks go by, and they're ready to come into the track. And Judge called me. He says, hey, those horses will be coming in today. I said, there's no they. You said $5,000 for them.
Right.
I said him, the other horse, so Ambazombie was the throw-in.
Oh, come on.
That's just proof. Yeah.
Wow. The gift horse.
Gift horse, yeah. Did all right for that.
He goes on to win multiple grade ones, wins 12 of 29 starts, earns nearly $2 million in his career. That's one hell of a gift, Bill.
You know, he's disqualified from two wins, too.
Wow. Well, what made him so special?
He was an athlete. When we cut him, it really helped him. But he could run. He had all the tools. He was a good-looking horse. The way he got across the ground was special. Covered a lot of ground. He could actually route, but he's a better sprinter. But he had the look of a horse, and he did everything right. Good eater, did it all. He had the whole thing.
When he unexpectedly arrives in your barn, and he's, as you said, the throw-in horse to the whole deal, what do you remember about him at that point? Did he look like he was a grade one winner?
No, not when he came in. I'd be foolish to say that. But he would wash out, and he was still running well. And I told my best friend was Tom Sanford, and I said, you need to cut him, make him a better horse. And that really helped him a lot. He put more energy in the races than he did saddling in the paddock.
And, of course, Ambazombie came a few years after another grade one winner you trained, and that was Borden Arrow, who, boy, Borden Arrow could really run.
Oh, yeah. He was a fun horse. Yeah, another fun horse. Got a lot of good memories there.
Yeah. What's your favorite Borden Arrow memory?
The way he was consistent. He was always in the race. And he would try. He would try to beat you. He wanted to beat you every time.
Well, and he beat a lot of good ones, and he won quite often, did Borden Arrow. So did another horse you trained. I'll throw this name at you, and you can tell me the story. Exchange. Tell me about Exchange.
Oh, there's a story. How we got her. One morning... It was really early in the morning. It was still dark, and we caught her working a half mile in like 46 and change. We didn't know who it was, and my assistant Daryl said, "Go down and run down the gap and get her markings." And so we knew she had some white hair and chestnut, and then I had all her markings. And we looked at, and it wasn't recorded, so we didn't know who it was. We knew who the trainer was. We didn't know who the horse was. So I told Sid Craig about it. I said, when this horse runs, if it runs for claiming, we got to claim it. So he had money on account, and we waited and waited, and then this trainer, we won't mention it, he had a chestnut horse in for 50. And I said, this could be her. I knew it was a filly, and I had the markings. And when she went over we didn't know we were going to claim it, so it went over to the paddock. And I said, this is her. And so we went and put the claim in, history after that.
Wow. Yeah, and boy, she could, you talk about a filly that could really run. She won 15 of her 30 starts. She was second in seven of those. She had four thirds. She earned almost $1.3 million. And you got to team up with the great Lafitte Pinkai Jr. with her, too.
They're both fighters, weren't they?
Yeah, they certainly were. They certainly were. Lafitte's somebody who you've you've got a lot of respect for.
I have a couple of stories about him you'd love.
Go for it.
Are we running out of time?
No, we have plenty of time. Go for it.
Okay. I had a great filly. We were at Hollywood Park. I had a great filly. It was just a nut job. It was a maiden bottom, as I recall. And Lafitte was friends with the owners. And this is when he was in the 50 area when nobody wanted, you know, he was getting up there. And I didn't want to put him on her because she would throw the riders off all the time. And I, well, he doesn't need this. But anyway, so we got her in the paddock. We got him running next to her, gave him a leg up. They got over around the half-mile pole, and off he comes. I said, oh, no, Bill. What, I'm talking to myself. What are you doing here? What are you doing putting him on? He gets back on and with the pony, and they go over to the quarter pole. And he gets off around the quarter pole again, and he walks her up to the gate with a pony. And they gets on, and she runs around the race, and she runs a bad fourth. So when they unsaddle, and I grab Lafitte, and I'm walking with him back to the jock's room, and I said, Lafitte, I am so sorry for putting you on this, and I'm just apologizing. I can't say enough to apologize. And he just stops there, and I just look back, and I keep walking. He's waiting for my assistant, Daryl Rader, and they chat, and he walks away, and I said, Daryl, what did Lafitte want? He's afraid you're going to take him off to Philly. You know what? She won her next start with Lafitte, but that's Lafitte. Oh, my. Oh, my. I got another one where we were in Santa Anita, and I had a horse that was an outside post, and horse would try to bolt. You know, had all the outside cups, and we had all the equipment. He'd still bolt. He'd get out really bad. And Lafitte was on him, and he breaks from the gate. He gets to the outside and down the backside. He's getting out, and he gets to the turn, and he's bolting. He's getting out. When he turns into the stretch, he's outside on the berm. You know the berm where the drop-off is, where the head-on can hardly see the horse. He's so far out.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's a photo, and he's riding like he's in the Derby. He is riding his butt off. He's riding. And so he might have won. He might not. The photo comes up, and he wins. So we get in the winner's circle, and then we get off, and I start talking to him. I said, Lafitte, horse feel okay? He says, oh, yeah. Maybe his feet by me. You okay? So I walk away, and he runs up to me. He grabs my arm, and he says, you know what? He does get out a little bit. Here's a horse that's bolting the whole way, and he says, he's not worried. He's just trying to get out a little bit. Oh, love the guy.
That's great. You know, Lafitte was so dedicated throughout his entire career, and he still continues to be that way, even in retirement now. And he's one of my favorite people to talk with because he was so smart, and he had to endure and overcome so many different things as he was first getting started. He's just a great story.
You know, smart. People didn't really appreciate him for that. I'd go to the farms every 2 or 3 weeks to look at I call the wounded or the ones we laid up, maybe mm-hmm. need some time. And I'd do that, you know, every month once or twice. And one time he says, Bill, you're going out to the farms? And I said, yeah. He said, can I go with you? I said, sure. I love the company. So we get out to some paddocks, and we look at horses out there that he had rode. And he oh, Bill, that's so-and-so. Or that's he'd know before I even told him the name who the horses were. That's how you think as many horses as he rode. He remembers things like that. He was a smart guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Visiting with trainer Bill Sparr here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton, recalling some of the top moments in his career, which he wrapped up at the end of February. Almost 50 years of training racehorses, and there are so many stories we could tell. I told you during the commercial break, Bill, that we probably need a 2 or 3 hour show here because we're really just getting started. I read in the Daily Racing Form article about your retirement, or at least your disbanding of your stable. I won't call it a retirement because I know you don't want to go down that road. But I read where there was a time that you had some old-time gypsy trainers as your racetrack neighbors. Tell me a little bit about them.
I got one. I was working for the vet and actually Doc Robbins at that time, and it was Ed Burke. Mr. Quarter Horse, he when he retired, he got some thoroughbreds, and he was down on the shed, and we had a few horses, and he said, can you help him out for a couple of weeks until he finds a groom? And so I was grooming some horses for him, and there was a couple twin brothers there, older guys, probably in their 60s, and they would had a four-horse van, and they would travel around all the time together, like all the fairs, and they had some stalls there at Santa Anita. So they were very frugal. They watched every penny, and they were known to gamble, but you never know it. And their horses, they would win races, and they would have big payoffs. But what did they do with the money? Nobody ever knew. So it was about 2 weeks to go before the meeting was over, and they come and got their horses, and they were going to a fair. I want to say friend or somewhere. Anyway, they loaded their horses up, and they took off. About a half an hour comes by, and and here they come in with their trailer, and they circle the barn area, and dust is flying. They're speeding in the barn area. They get in front of the barn, they get out. They start arguing they're pushing each other, and they're arguing. So they come with their empty stalls, and they said, Bill, I need to borrow your shovel. Okay. So they go in the stall, and they start digging. They buried their money in cans in there. And each brother thought the other one got it out. And they left the money there. So here's the funny part. So they get their money, or their cans, and they take off again. As soon as they left the ground, I think an army of grooms and hot workers showed up at those stalls with shovels, digging every stall up. They thought maybe they left the can there.
Bill, I think I understand why you're going to have such a difficult time staying away from the racetrack.
I got to mention Joe Manzi.
Yeah, all of these stories, all of these moments in your career, and I know that there are so many others, but all of these moments, it makes it so difficult to walk away from this profession.
Well, I have good memories.
Yep. Yeah, you certainly do. You were telling me during the break about a horse by the name of Stained Glass. Tell me about that.
Joe Manzi, yes. I was working for the vet. I was assistant for Joe Manzi. He taught me so much. He was come up under Whittingham. Joe got sick for a long period, and I was a groom for him, and I worked for the vet too. And I had it when I came in each day as assistant trainer. I had to check with Charlie first at his barn. I parked my car by his barn every day and check in with Charlie. And then when I left, I had to check with Charlie again in case I had any questions. And we bought a horse called Stained Glass from Connie Ring. And I introduced him to the horse because Connie Ring needed some money, and Roger Clapp had the horses. And I said, I've been by this horse, and he just won a maiden allowance race, and they only want $25,000 for him. And so I brought Joe over, and he was laying in the stall, the horse, not Joe. It was laying in the stall, and we got him up. He had a big screen. I remember that. And then he got him up, and he had a big belly. He said, Bill, is this the horse Stained Glass? I said, yeah. He ran out to his car, he got his checkbook, and wrote a check for $25,000. He didn't have the owner yet, but he got a Rod Steiger and a lady called Reva Groen to buy the horse together. And we think we're running back in a stake after that race, maybe another race in between. But the fact this is my first horse I saddle as the stake horse. And Kelly Savalas had his horse in there, Kelly's Pop, with Mel Studi in the stake, and we had Stained Glass with Rod Steiger. Well, they didn't get along very well, these two actors. I didn't know that. And so we won the race and beat the other horse. And Rod Steiger was just, he was so happy to win the race. I don't know if it was winning the race or more that he beat Telly Savalas' horse. So that night, he took me out to dinner at the Talk of the Town. He was shooting a movie called W.C. Fields and Me, and he was in character all night. And it was a hoot. I had dinner with W.C. Fields.
Fantastic.
Oh, and people would come over to the table and to sign autographs and sign their program. Oh, yeah, oh, man, oh, let me see here. Yeah, okay, what do I sign, W.C. Fields or Rod Steiger? It was so much fun.
Wow, that's fantastic. And you know, you mentioned Telly Savalas too, and there are so many notable celebrities and actors in particular that have been involved with racehorses over the years. Who are some of the other celebrities, if you will, that you had the chance to be around, Bill?
Well, let's see. There was a couple other ones. One is a funny story is I had Bill Gumper. I claimed a horse called Sisney for him, and it turned out to be a pretty good horse. And went in races, and he had a real good friend named Bill Gumper. Anyway, he had a daughter that had a boyfriend named Dusty, and they got engaged. And whenever the horse would run, Bill Godsaken was his name. And whenever the horse would run, they would all come out. And it would be Bill Godsaken, his daughter, and Dusty, their friend. And so we were at a couple of races. Dusty always came out. And it was in the paddock at Santa Anita, and the guy, he was all nondescript. He was a short guy, and he had Levi's on and a T-shirt all the time. And he'd come up, and he was real quiet, and he'd come next to me, and the horse was doing good. I said, that horse is doing really well. So I turned to Bill. I said, you know, Dusty, he looks just like Dustin Hoffman. It is Dustin Hoffman.
Come on.
No, it's true story. True story, yeah. And he ended up doing that movie there called Luck, and we touched bases with him there. It was Dustin Hoffman, but he never recognized him the way he looked on film and didn't see him in the paddock.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's a great story. So if you're going to think back, Bill, on some of the other horses that we haven't talked about yet, I know there are others, so many others that have you've been around either before you started training or after, you know, you launched your own training career. But if you're going to think about all the horses and some of the ones that really stand out to you, who are some of the names going to be?
Help me out here. Let's see.
I would imagine Midnight Bisou has to hold a special place.
Oh boy. What a nice filly. I trained her easy, you know, because when I got her, she had some minor skin issues and stuff. And I always breeze her easy, keep her in herself. I thought she had good action. And now John Sheriff was a good friend. We were working teams together, and I was working her with a company, one of John's. And John said, well, mine's a pretty good filly. We're going 49. He says, but yours is better. And I said, I didn't really know that she was that special until we run her a mile, and she at the half mile pole, she I had one or two horses beat, and she circled them so fast from there to the wire. I said, oh my, because when horses, real runners, they can go fast from the 3/8 pole to half mile pole and throw 12s at you or even faster, they're good horses. And she did it easy. I said, well, we got a real runner here. That's when she showed me she was a runner, and you know, she won the big race at Santa Anita. Then we went on, and in the race at Churchill, she got knocked down at the gate, and Mike Smith said took all the air out of her getting out of the gate. She still ran, I think, third that day.
Yeah, she was special. And then, as we know, she went and finished her career outside of your barn. After she left, were you still actively following her and cheering for her like one of your children?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that from a lot of trainers over the years on this show, where it's tough when they have horses that are moved to other trainers, but boy, they, especially the good ones, they become like their children, and they cheer for them just the same.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are the good guys. Those are the good guys.
Yep. Yeah. I'll give you one more name, and you can tell me the story. Sky Diamonds.
Oh yeah, we claimed her. We claimed her for 32,000 or 40?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It should wash out, and we got her really comfortable. really comfortable. I want to come back to Mr. Gennaro, though, after Sky Diamond.
Yeah.
She turned out to be, I had John Lindo involved with her, and I had some other, well, the owners I'm talking to Mr. Gennaro here.
I mean,
the way Davey claimed her that she came over, I knew she always washed out coming over, and one of the owners said, Billy, you better think about making the dump in the claim, because she's got real washed. She said, oh, she always does that. Don't worry about it. But, yeah, she was a lot of fun. We actually run her in the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, she was tough. She could really run. She ended up winning 10 starts. 10 of her 24 starts, she earned almost $700,000. So she was a really hard-knocking California bred. We're down to about 3 minutes, Bill. You said there was another name that you wanted to mention.
Mr. Gennaro. We claimed him, and he got hurt today. We got him, and he was a good horse. And we had no place to run him. We ran him off of a layoff. We took him and ran him in the Gold Cup at Phoenix. They run 107 and change. Frank Oliveris rode him that day, and it turned out to be a real good horse that we end up going to Louisiana. And I teamed up with Bobby Frankel that made a deal with him. He had favorites in all the races, and that last week they have, with each day they have a stake race and they have a sprinter. They give bonuses to trainers. If you win two or three races, you got $20,000. If you win four, you got $50,000. You win them all, you got $100,000. And Bobby and I spent a whole week together, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, great story. Bill Sparr here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Bill, I always like to wrap up the final couple of minutes of the show by asking trainers to let us know something about them that we haven't talked about yet, and I'm sure there's plenty of things we haven't gotten to, but I will say this. I think it's appropriate that we're doing this show during March Madness, because if I understand correctly, you enjoyed playing a little basketball from time to time.
Yeah. It maybe relaxed me. It kept me busy, you know, like in between, after I finished training, I'd go over to the court and shoot baskets with some friends. And the workout really helped me thinking.
Well, what's next for Bill Sparr? Where are we going to see you again?
I hope in the winner's circle with some friends.
Perfect way to end the show, Bill. That would be a wonderful way to continue on your legacy and everything that you've built and your love of the game. So I want to thank you for spending this hour with me here. It's been a delight, and all the best moving forward.
I just want to say one thing about Joe Manzi. I have not said enough about him, but he was a big, big help in my life, and he was a great guy.
Wonderful stuff. Bill Sparr here on Trainer.
Way too soon.
Yeah, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Bill, appreciate the visit, and all the best, my friend. I'm sure we'll talk again very soon.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Thanks, Michael.
All right, Bill Sparr, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. What an hour, huh? If you missed any portion, head back and check out the podcast, horseracingradio.net, and on every major podcast platform. My thanks to Bill and to Lee Delapina in our studio. I'm Mike Penna.